Hi, hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Advancing Pharmacist Engagement in Biliary Tract Cancer, Disease State and Treatment Considerations. I am Courtney Cavallari, PharmD BCOP, a clinical oncology pharmacist at Huntsman Cancer Institute at the University of Utah, and I am joined today by Kenneth Tam, PharmD BCOP, a clinical oncology pharmacist at UW Medicine Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center. In this episode, we will discuss the role of the pharmacist in the management of patients with biliary tract cancers. Thank you so much for joining us. So let's begin. So, Kenneth, can you start us off by going over the epidemiology, some risk factors, and clinical presentation of biliary tract cancers?
Yeah, thank you, Courtney. The biliary tract cancers, compared to many other types of cancers, are a much rarer disease state. There's some estimates that in 2024, there will be about 41,000 new cases, with about 12,500 new deaths. And this is a lot smaller compared to other types of cancers, such as lung cancer, where in the US, there can be up to 225,000 new cases estimated. So it's not one of the more common cancers, and I think that's why there's a lot of awareness that needs to be brought to it. It's something that maybe we don't think about typically when we list types of cancers. And I know recently a lot of awareness and advocacy has been brought around these kinds of cancers, given that Randy Moss, a big NFL player and a public figure, was recently diagnosed with cholangiocarcinoma. And he's been bringing his experience and sharing his journey with the public. In terms of risk factors, many of these are associated with inflammatory conditions. So specifically with gallbladder cancer, for example, gallstones can be a risk factor. Other chronic inflammatory conditions, things such as primary sclerosing cholangitis, and even inflammatory bowel disease has some association. With the cholangiocarcinomas, the other side, we have, again, more of the chronic inflammation. Also, hepatitis B and hepatitis C have been associated with it. And fatty liver disease could also be a risk factor. In terms of presentation, because of the anatomic location, many of them are the presenting symptoms are nonspecific. So things like fever, weight loss, abdominal pain, which may not necessarily bring clinicians towards the diagnosis of a biliary tract cancer. However, one symptom specifically for extrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas is the presence of jaundice, the yellowing of the skin and the whites of the eyes. Survival rates for biliary tract cancers compared to other cancers are quite low. The 5-year overall survival is estimated around 10 to 20% across all stages at diagnosis. So it's important to bring awareness to this relatively rare and potentially serious disease. Courtney, I was wondering if you could share with us what are some of the main biomarkers that are analyzed in patients with biliary tract cancers, and how do these impact treatment decisions?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, and I appreciate you talking about the awareness of these cancers because they are so rare. For biomarkers and pertinent molecular alterations, we're often doing next generation sequencing for a full panel of anything we can catch, really. But the alterations that really have the most impact are IDH1 and 2 mutations, the FGFR2 fusions or rearrangements, and then ERBB2 or HER2 amplification and mutations. So IDH1 and FGFR2 fusions are predominantly found in our intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, and so these are treatment options a lot more for those types of patients. We also do tend to see KRAS and TP53 mutations more commonly in our extrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas. Depending on the KRAS mutation, this may or may not be targetable. And then our ERBB2 or HER2 alterations are particularly common in gallbladder cancers and then our extrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas as well. We do see some other actionable alterations with BRAF V600E mutations, NTRK fusions, and any of the DNA damage repair mutations, so like with BRCA, dMMR, but these are a lot less frequent. We still test for them, but it's not really a reliable alteration to target. And so we actually do have guideline recommendations. So within the NCCN guidelines, it is recommended that patients at least get testing for IDH1, FGFR2 fusions or rearrangements, BRAF V600E, and the ERBB2 or HER2 amplification and mutations. We're also testing for some of those other alterations that I mentioned with KRAS, NTRK, MSI high or dMMR. And then possibly the BRCA1 and 2, especially if patients have a higher family history of that. So, in general, though, we are still doing those comprehensive genomic profiling tests using next generation sequencing because there could always be some other molecular alteration that we can take action on. What's also more, a lot, or very important for these patients is potentially getting them on clinical trials. So if they have some alteration that we either don't have an FDA-approved medication for, or it's approved in another disease state and we can't necessarily get it for these patients, they might tend to be eligible for some clinical trials that are in targeted patients. And with the rarity of these cancers, and we don't have a lot of biliary tract cancer-specific clinical trials, it's really important for them to be getting into these more targeted therapy trials. So, Kenneth, like talking on our therapies, can you elaborate on our therapies that are used in the first and second line setting for biliary tract cancers?
Yeah, absolutely. In the first line setting, a lot of the regimens are actually cytotoxic chemotherapy. Typically, a regimen, a gemcitabine-containing regimen. According to the NCCN guidelines, one of the first line category one recommendations is gemcitabine with cisplatin. This was compared against gemcitabine alone and was found to Those patients were found to have better outcomes, leading that to be the standard of care. More recently, gemcitabine with cisplatin as the backbone has been added to a chemoimmunotherapy regimen. So gemcitabine cisplatin, in addition to a checkpoint inhibitor such as durvalumab and pembrolizumab, and this was has come out in the past couple of years and has really moved that the chemoimmunotherapy regimens to the front line in eligible patients. Other options for first line treatment include other types of gemcitabine-based regimens, so gemcitabine with a different partner, such as albumin-bound paclitaxel, and various fluoropyrimidine-based regimens. So things like FOLFOX and CAPOX could also be used in the first line setting. Although, again, most of the preponderance of data is with those gemcitabine-based regimens. And now with the chemoimmunotherapies. Given the rarity of the cancer and the presence of these mutations, there are also options to use certain targeted treatments in the first line setting. So those NTRK inhibitors that you were speaking about, Courtney, and also potentially RET inhibitors in eligible patients. Of course, those patients have to have that mutation. In addition to that, patients who have microsatellite instability high or tumor mutation burden high could also receive checkpoint inhibitors or as a single agent or in combination with CTLA-4 inhibitor. But the way things are moving now is with the, again, with the combination chemoimmunotherapy, since a lot of patients will be eligible for chemoimmunotherapy in the first line setting, regardless of their mutation status. In the second line setting, looking again at our chemotherapy regimens, I'd say the one of the more preferred regimens is FOLFOX, which was specifically studied in the subsequent line setting. Other regimens can include irinotecan-based regimens, such as FOLFIRI or fluorouracil with nanoliposomal irinotecan, or even regorafenib in the subsequent line setting. And then, as you mentioned, In the subsequent line setting, a lot of the targeted treatments come out depending on the mutational any mutations that are identified. So, for example, in patients who are BRAF V600E, those patients can receive dabrafenib/trametinib. For patients who have FGFR2 fusions, those patients have a whole slew of FGFR inhibitors that can be used. IDH1 mutations can receive IDH1 inhibitors, ivosidenib. And then patients who have the ERBB2 or the HER2 mutations or amplifications, those patients can receive HER2-directed therapy. Courtney, since on the topic of these targeted treatments, I was wondering if you could share with us some of the key data for specifically the FGFR2 mutations, because those aren't commonly used in a lot of other cancers.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty unique space for the cholangiocarcinomas. We do see FGFR2 in some of the genitourinary space, but really it's kind of unique to our biliary tract cancers. The most robust clinical data are for pemigatinib and futibatinib, and these were mostly studied in previously treated unresectable or metastatic intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas with FGFR2 fusions or rearrangements. So pemigatinib, it's a selective FGFR1 through 3 inhibitor. This was studied in the phase 2 FIGHT-202 trial and showed a pretty decent overall response rate of about 35%. And a median progression-free survival of 6.9 months. And so this trial led to an FDA indication for pemigatinib in this space. Futibatinib is a next-generation irreversible FGFR1 through 4 inhibitor. And this also showed a really good objective response rate of 42% in the phase 2 PHOENIX CCA2 trial, and a median duration of response of about 9.7 months. And a progression-free survival of 9 months. There's an honorable mention I do want to speak about, which is infigratinib. This is another FGFR1 through 3 inhibitor that also showed decent response rates in a similar population. However, this was voluntarily withdrawn from the US market last year in 2024, more due to commercial reasons and not for efficacy or safety concerns. So the data are out there for this drug, although actually accessing it is unlikely at this point. So we really focus on pemigatinib and futibatinib. And the adverse effect profile for these drugs is also a little bit unique. One of the most common side effects that we deal with these drugs is hyperphosphatemia. And so this is a huge monitoring piece of starting patients on these drugs and a huge counseling piece as well. Some other issues we see with these drugs include dermatologic toxicities and nail toxicities, so like paronychia and hand-foot-skin reaction. So we're really monitoring patients for those types of issues. We see some other issues with like stomatitis and dry mouth. And then there are more rare ocular toxicities that we have to monitor patients for and educate them about in case they have any changes in their vision. And we're also seeing some issues with diarrhea and fatigue with these agents as well. But I would say probably the hyperphosphatemia and the nail and dermatologic toxicities are the big ones that we manage in, on a day-to-day basis. So, kind of switching gears, Kenneth, can you touch on the our HER2 agents that we have in biliary tract cancers? And can you tell us the kind of the key differences between trastuzumab deruxtecan and zanidatamab in terms of mechanism of action and toxicity profiles?
Yeah, I think these two are really interesting agents. I think they're really cool when we talk about their mechanism of action. And both of them are definitely options in the HER2 amplified biliary tract cancers in the subsequent line setting. I think the first one, famtrastuzumab deruxtecan, of course, has been studied in a lot of different cancers, not just biliary tract cancers. And its mechanism of action is an antibody-drug conjugate. So there is the specific antibody, in this case, trastuzumab, which is directed against HER2. And then there's a payload, which is a cytotoxic chemotherapy, which in this case is a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor. So deruxtecan, irinotecan, very similar mechanisms there. And they're attached by a linker so that when the antibody, the trastuzumab, goes to the HER2, the cells that express HER2, and essentially gets taken up and drops off this cytotoxic chemo. It's kind of like a smart missile. It has a targeting system and it has a payload. And I find this just really fascinating. I think it's a really cool mechanism. On the other side, zanidatamab also has a really cool mechanism. It is a antibody that is directed against two different epitopes on the HER2 protein. So rather than trastuzumab, which only binds to one subdomain, subdomain 4, zanidatamab actually binds to both subdomain 4 and subdomain 2. So it binds to both the extracellular juxtamembrane domain as well as the dimerization domain. It's kind of like trastuzumab on one arm and pertuzumab on the other arm. And so by binding this in this way, it is able to induce antibody-dependent cytotoxicity, complement-dependent cytotoxicity in a way that's more effective than just targeting one epitope. And so you, by looking at the mechanism of action, you can kind of see the differences in the toxicity profiles as it is. Famtrastuzumab deruxtecan has the toxicity profile of trastuzumab, so the HER2-directed toxicities, things like cardiac toxicity, reversible cardiomyopathy. And in addition to that, it also has the chemo-related toxicities from the payload. And so we see nausea, myelosuppression from that side as well. And in addition, I think one of the more serious side effects and something that a lot of people are watching out for with famtrastuzumab deruxtecan is that it can cause pneumonitis or inflammatory lung disease. And so that's always something that, regardless of the disease state that it's being used in, that investigators are watching out for because that rate can be relatively high. Looking at zanidatamab, the toxicity profile of that is more similar to antibodies, so more similar to the combination of trastuzumab and pertuzumab. You have those the cardiac toxicities requiring cardiac monitoring, and then you also have some of the toxicity is associated with the binding of the other epitope. So I think of diarrhea, for example, being more common with the double binding as opposed to the single binding with trastuzumab. But favorably, perhaps favorably, you don't have those chemotherapy-related side effects because these are just there's no chemo attached to it. So this can be somewhat attractive for that particular agent. Courtney, I was wondering if you could share with us, now that we have some of the background behind these agents, I was wondering if you could share with us some of the key data between for both of these in the use of biliary tract cancer. And how do you differentiate between the two in your practice?
So I'll start first with the trastuzumab deruxtecan. The key data for this actually came out of a tumor agnostic trial. It was the Destiny Pan-Tumor02 phase 2 trial. And this looked at trastuzumab deruxtecan in all-comer patients with HER2 positive disease. And they define this as either IHC 3+ or 2+. The results of this trial actually did lead to the FDA accelerated approval for a tumor agnostic indication in HER2 positive IHC 3+ patients. And that's because in the trial, across all patients from all different disease states, they saw an objective response rate of 37.1%. And this was across both the 3+ and the 2+ patients. And the overall response for the 41 biliary tract patients was 22%. However, when they looked at just the IHC 3+ patients, this jumped to 56.3%. Additionally, the impressive data with the progression-free survival for the biliary tract cancer patients, specifically with IHC 3+ HER2 positive disease, was 7.4 months. So again, this was a phase two trial. We weren't comparing it to anything, but this was also in patients who had received prior therapies. And so the promising response rates and the promising progression-free survival is really encouraging and what helped garner that FDA approval. Switching over to zanidatamab, this was studied in the phase two Horizon BTC01 trial. And this looked at zanidatamab in patients with HER2 amplified, unresectable, locally advanced, or metastatic biliary tract cancers specifically. So, whereas our DESTINY trial looked at a broad spectrum of disease states, the HORIZON trial was specifically in our biliary tract cancer patients. And this was after progression on a gemcitabine-based therapy. They saw really promising results and had a confirmed overall response rate of 52% in what they deemed the HER2 positive cohort, which was both the IHC 2+ and the IHC 3+. And the median progression-free survival, again, was pretty impressive. And they looked at this just in the 3+ patients and saw a progression-free survival of 7.2 months. So this trial led to the FDA approval for zanidatamab in our biliary tract cancer patients with HER2 positive disease with the IHC 3+ status. In terms of differentiating between these two agents, I think it would really have to be on a case-by-case basis. Both agents really demonstrated not only statistically, well, excuse me, I can't say that, not statistically significant, but numerically pretty impressive results. Also, clinically meaningful activity in our HER2 positive patients, especially those with IHC 3+ status. We would really start looking at these agents kind of in a more nuanced way in terms of the toxicities they both produce, the schedule that we can give them on, what patients have received before, what kind of sequelae they're having from their other treatments, I think, to really choose between the two agents. These agents haven't been compared head to head, so we really only have their respective phase two data to go off of. And so, like I said, I think this would just be a case-by-case basis on which agent we would choose for individual patients. So now that we've talked about some of our specific agents, Kenneth, can you touch on what the role of the pharmacist is in treatment selection and how we can work best with our physician colleagues and then with the patients to optimize treatment?
Yeah, I think a lot of the role of the pharmacist has a lot to do with a lot of what you'd mentioned in the previous question, Courtney. Pharmacists really know these medications inside and out, even down to like the administration time, the frequency of the administration, the side effects that we and the monitoring frequency. And this can be very useful when helping decide between re one regimen or another. Patients who may have, for example, if they have previous pulmonary issues or pre-existing pulmonary conditions that may not have a physiologic reserve, we may point out the possible pulmonary toxicity of an agent like trastuzumab deruxtecan, and help build monitoring parameters or monitoring plans to ensure that these are given safe can be given safely. And I think a lot of it is that knowledge base that comes out when talking with physicians, providers, and patients. I think it's really good that we have that knowledge and are able to share it, counseling patients about these medications, these kind of unusual side effects. Some patients, when they think of cancer treatment, they kind of think of hair loss, lose weight loss, things like that. And they may be very surprised to hear about the unique toxicities of these FGFR inhibitors, which are completely different to a lot of what people may think of initially when they think of cancer treatment. So I think being available for that knowledge base, sharing that education with physicians and patients is where we're able to make the most impact, especially for these rare disease states and these rarer drugs. We can make sure that the medications are given safely and effectively. Courtney, I kind of touched on this in my answer to that, but toxicity management, because there's all these different toxicities are possible from all these agents, and they're very wide ranging. Can you tell us what the role of the pharmacist is in toxicity management? And from a pharmacist perspective, when might you suggest going from a first line agent to a subsequent line agent?
Yeah, I love that you highlighted the monitoring because I think that is a huge key part for the toxicity management in this. You really hit the nail on the head by saying, pharmacists can help develop monitoring plans. So with, ILD from trastuzumab deruxtecan to monitoring for hyperphosphatemia. I think that's really a key part that pharmacists can get involved with from the beginning. So, with our FGFR inhibitors, creating some monitoring plans where we're knowing how often the patients are going to come in to get their FOS checked, knowing what we're going to do, having kind of an algorithm, the package inserts for our FGFR inhibitors have pretty clear recommendations on what to do for FOS, for elevated FOS, when to initiate phosphate binders. And so the pharmacist can really help work that into the clinic workflow and the clinic algorithm of knowing, like, okay, these patients are just starting. When are we going to bring them in for lab checks? Who's going to communicate with the patient? And helping to create those systems so that, they're in place as soon as the patients start. To kind of delve more into the FGFR inhibitors as well. Education. I know a lot of pharmacists love to educate patients. We love talking to patients. That's why a lot of us got into this field. And so, really highlighting for patients what they can do and giving them some control. So, talking to them about a low phosphate diet, really encouraging them and talking to them about the importance of going to these lab checks and getting their blood monitored. Also, educating on how to take our phosphate binders. So a lot of the times we can start off with pretty ubiquitous medications such as calcium carbonate, but sometimes we have to go to a higher prescription level phosphate binder. And so educating the patients on how to take these, when to take these, how much you're taking, why you're taking them again. And then counseling also these patients on the skin and nail toxicities. So what should they watch out for? How to manage some of the, especially the nail toxicities that are a little bit more nuanced to take care of. We can really encourage and empower patients to take care of those things. And then one of the other things to mention to patients, especially on the FGFR inhibitors, is these kind of ocular toxicities that are not super common, but can be incredibly serious. And so letting them know about again, empowering them to contact the team if they have vision changes, especially, on one side, and giving them again the power to take care of, their journey. And then just to kind of touch on the HER2 therapies, you've already kind of really highlighted the importance of monitoring and looking out for ILD or pneumonitis with especially trastuzumab deruxtecan. And so, again, getting the pharmacist involved in what does that monitoring look like? What does the management look like? What's our algorithm? So that way, when it happens, you are good to go with the team. One of the other things to talk about with patients too is the importance of the echo monitoring for the ejection fraction reductions. I always like to tell patients, you know, this is why we're doing this. This is why it's important. We want to make sure your heart is staying healthy, so that way they know the importance of keeping up to date with those appointments. For the second part of your question about when would a pharmacist suggest going from first line agents to second line agents? We really try and maximize time on therapy as long as it's working. So, as long as patients are having any kind of response or even just stable disease, we're going to try and maximize that time on those therapies because we have so few options for patients with biliary tract cancers, especially so few targeted options, which a lot of patients tend to like, especially the oral options, because they're not coming in for IV infusions and having very long days. And this is why it's so important for toxicity management for these patients and keeping an eye on them and making sure that we're able to keep them on these therapies for as long as possible with manageable or few side effects, so that way we can really squeeze all we can out of the therapies as long as they're working.
Yeah, thank you, Courtney, for that excellent discussion. I'd also like to thank our viewing audience today, and I'd hope you found that this Pharmacy Times Medcast was educational. So, on behalf of all of us, thank you and have a great day.